From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Get ready to pay for your data usage. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, and for the rest of your life. Comcast, the nation's largest cable operator and internet provider and owner of NBC Universal, decided this week to begin the process of preparing you psychologically. Comcast has had infamous dust-ups with its internet subscribers. In 2007, it was the subject of an FCC complaint that it was secretly throttling the bandwidth of heavy downloaders. After that fight was resolved, the company began to cap its users' data usage to ensure that they wouldn't download too much. But on Thursday, Comcast announced that it would lift the cap and instead begin charging users whose data use surpasses a certain amount, sort of like your cell phone's data plan. The thing is, only a very, very few of us are ever likely to exceed that amount. This is, for now, for most of us, an academic exercise. But Comcast is preparing the ground for us to think differently about the way things work. Brian Stelter reports on media for the New York Times. Welcome to the show.
Sure.
First of all, let me ask you, as goes Comcast, so goes the rest of the industry?
That's oftentimes true because it's one of the largest providers of TV and internet in the country. Other companies take their lead from Comcast, and Comcast oftentimes sends signals about where they believe the industry's going. In this case, they're not quite first to say that we should be paying based on how much we consume. And of course, it's something that wireless companies already do. So by announcing this, I think Comcast is acting like AT&T and Verizon, which already charge you based on how much data you're using on your cell phone.
So why is this a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal because the foundation of all the services being created on the internet is this broadband connection that we all have into our homes. All the Netflixes of the world, all the future Netflixes that are being invented now, rely on this wired foundation that's been built into the ground. Companies like Comcast, I think what they're trying to do is reprice and start to change consumers' mindsets about how much broadband is worth. Already, Comcast lets you choose from a variety of speeds. You can pay more to have a faster connection. And I can imagine in the future having to choose both how fast a connection I want as well as how much data I want to be able to use.
Some suggest that Comcast is making this change because they see which way the wind is blowing. People aren't using cable very much. They're making a lot more money off of their broadband internet service, and that's where they see the gravy train coming.
Cable companies like Comcast have been shedding cable subscribers for a while, even as they add broadband. That's because there's lots of pressure from satellite companies and telcos for all those cable subscribers. As cable continues to shrink, then we're going to see these companies that used to be called cable companies really be called internet companies that just happen to serve up some TV on the side.
I mean, we're always worried about the people who control the pipes. Is everybody going to get a fair shake? Is everybody going to have the same access to information? And a lot of people complain that Comcast is exempting its own services from its own cap.
There are questions about that because Comcast recently started providing a service that's a little bit like Netflix via the Xbox for its users. And that service is not counting against the monthly allotment of data. This is something that the critics of Comcast have worried about for a long time, the idea of discriminating against the public internet and favoring this other private internet that benefits Comcast. And of course, because Comcast now controls NBC and a bunch of cable channels, that's been on the radar screen of the FCC as well as some public interest groups. Comcast has said that what they're doing with the Xbox data is the data is not traveling over the public internet, and thus its business relationship with Microsoft is exempt. But it makes a company like Netflix wonder, well, why isn't my data available to be distributed the same way? And so Netflix has actually been the loudest opponent of this experiment.
I thought it was interesting that Comcast Executive Vice President David Cohen said, it's a matter of messaging way more than it's a matter of capacity. This is a psychological move more than a business move, right?
He has been saying that he was concerned that all of the cool new products they were announcing lately were being overshadowed by people wondering, how's it going to affect my data usage? But I would say that the wireless companies show us maybe what this future looks like. I do worry on almost daily basis about not using too much of my AT&T data on my iPhone every month. that kind of reality is something that people are getting used to already on their wireless phones. For other people, it might be texting. For other people, it might be the number of minutes they're using to make phone calls. So old-fashioned, the phone there. But either way, I think people are being trained to think about how much they're consuming.
Can we trust Comcast to play fair with its consumers? It doesn't have the greatest reputation either for transparency or for service.
Comcast continues to be very closely watched, even by the standards of a media company, by consumer advocates and by public interest groups, and by people that are naturally suspicious of these big media companies. And especially closely watched because it now controls a lot of content in the form of NBC Universal. The fact that the government is keeping a close eye since that merger, every step they take is very carefully planned by them. That doesn't mean that they are necessarily trustworthy for a consumer. There's still a lot of people that are fed up with the long waits on the phone to reach a technician or the long waits at home or the high bills, but they're not an outlier in terms of other cable companies.
So as long as they're just as bad as the others, that's okay.
Yeah, it's something about a rising tide or maybe in this case a falling tide.
Is your phone more important to you?
Than my home internet connection?
Yeah.
It's my lifeline in the most real sense of the word. If I have to leave home or if I'm anywhere outside of home, the phone is what goes with me.
Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Stelter is a media reporter for the New York Times. So Stelter says that despite broadband's prominence, his phone is still more important to him. And that's probably because he's using the data functions on it, not because he likes to make a bunch of calls, which, as you heard, he seems to find quaint. Tom Vanderbilt recently wrote about the legacy of the telephone call for the Wilson Quarterly. Tom, welcome to On the Media.
Great to be here, Brooke.
So recent research suggests that the phone call, if it isn't dead exactly, it seems to be dying.
Yeah, I think there's various numbers of ways to look at this. The landline, for example, is on the decline in almost every industrialized country. My own landline, like probably many listeners, sort of sits there like a lonely outpost for, you know, robocalls from politicians and calls from your parents, and voicemail tends to sit on there for days. And so obviously mobile phones took up a lot of the slack left by this huge decline in landlines. But even with mobile phones, it's been found that the average mobile phone call, which I think was a leisurely 3 minutes a few years ago, is down to just a little bit over 1 minute.
Now, when the phone call was invented, some people were afraid of it, and some people thought it was going to save us.
I think it's kind of set in motion this rather common pattern you see with technology. First is the period of trying to figure out what it's for. Then come these sort of early pronouncements of either gloom and doom or sort of utopian wish fulfillment. The gloom and doom was sort of that the telephone was going to erode communities. People weren't going to want to see each other face to face. And then kind of the crazy utopianism was that the telephone was going to be this harbinger of world peace. Once we could all have this internetwork, instant communication, we would reach out and touch someone, all the world's problems would be solved.
You pointed out in the piece you wrote for the Wilson Quarterly that not only were the dystopian fears the same for the telephone as they were later for the internet, tell me how predation and identity theft and financial market volatility figured in.
As with the internet, there was the idea that just the presence of more information more quickly would lead to more trades, more volatility. Of course, now we've seen that with this ultra-high-speed internet trading, with machines making trades with machines. With identity theft, you know, there was this thought that by establishing a telephone line, you're kind of crossing this public-private threshold that had been there, and that unwanted solicitors of various information could kind of hack into your home, for lack of a better word.
One of the most surprising things I read in your article was that even though phone utopians thought that the phone would make it easier for us to unite across great distances, a couple of MIT researchers found that the more people telecommunicate, the more they move closer to each other?
Carlo Ratti, a researcher at the Media Lab at MIT, did a study looking at people's mobile phone records and then their location in geography, and found that the more you called someone, the more likely you were to spend time in the same area code or zip code in the next year. People talk about the mobile phone as yet another device that would fragment cities, decentralize them. But think about how sort of essential the mobile phone is to urban life, just setting up meetings. We don't worry as much about running late because we can contact somebody. It's kind of another tool for urban life.
And journalists, of course, in the wake of the telephone, argued about what it would do to newspapers. You wrote about this thing called the Telephone Herald, which was described in a 1903 article, which would enable people to get their news by phone.
it was in some ways a proto-radio device. So the idea was you had this sort of horn on the wall that would blast an announcement, and then this kind of voice would come over the telephone wire telling you the events of the day in kind of a digest form, sort of like a Twitter feed, if you will. And you could tie in telephone connection to an opera performance. We'd all be listening to a telephoned version of an opera. So again, we just didn't really know what we were going to feel comfortable using the telephone for. And it wasn't until like the 1920s that you start to see these ads from AT&T urging people to call friends. I mean, in the beginning, you had these sort of pieces of furniture, and it had a big trumpet in the middle, and you would go to the desk to make your call. And then the phone gradually started to enter the household. It got smaller. It got colorful. You started to see it in the kitchen, then in the bedroom. You know, the first phones were found sort of out in the pantry or the front hallway of houses. And then it gradually migrated into the house, into our daily lives, eventually into your pocket.
We always imagined that video phoning would eventually replace the telephone, that people actually enjoyed talking on the phone and wanted to increase that engagement. But it turns out, as soon as people could get off the phone, they did.
Actually, the video phone was really projected as far back as Fritz Lang's Metropolis, 1927. For the whole century, this was always thought to be the way we, of course, wanted to talk once the technology became available. Of course, now we do have Skype, video conferencing.
That's true, but those tend to be for particular occasions.
Video phone, like you're saying, you know, I use it if I've been away from home for a long time, I want to see my daughter. It introduces all these other things that you just have to go through all sorts of other social niceties, if you were. I don't need to hear eight people around my seat on an airplane tell the other person on the phone that they've landed. Or, you know, you hear these banal things all day on the phone. I'm like, couldn't you just sort of send a text about that?
Well, Tom, thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Writer Tom Vanderbilt. His article for the Wilson Quarterly is called The Call of the Future.
Coming up, the boundaries of free speech in Libya and here in the U.S. And Germany prepares for the emergence into the public domain of Mein Kampf.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
Hi, I'm OTM producer Alex Goldman.
And I'm OTM producer PJ Vogt.
So the last time we were here, it was to ask people to give us nice reviews on iTunes, because we didn't really have that many.
I totally remember that. Did people do it?
People definitely did it. We shot up from about 300 reviews to just a shade under 1,000 reviews.
Wow. So why are we back here? It sort of feels like mission accomplished.
First of all, PJ, mission not accomplished. If you haven't reviewed us, please do. It really helps us move up in the iTunes rankings. That said, the reason we're here today is to actually talk about our website.
Right. We've been updating our website every single weekday with new content. It's all extra stuff that you can't hear on the radio. And we wanted to let you know about it so that you can check it out and you can tell us what we're doing right, what you want to see more of.
Right. This week, for instance, we've got a great post from OTM super producer Jamie York about a secret war that America engaged in, one where they dropped more bombs on a single country than the Allies dropped during all of World War II.
Whoa. I wonder which country we did that to.
Sorry, PJ. If you want to find out, you have to go to the website, blog.onthemedia.org.
You're a jerk. But also, there's a really good story about a guy who sort of hacked the ABC News website, and he was able to find out about the president's same-sex marriage endorsement before anybody else, before it was even reported. That's there, too.
So you're saying I'm a jerk, but I happen to have written that article.
Yeah.
So check out the blog, and please let us know what you think.
And review us on iTunes?
Yeah.
Mission accomplished.
What are you talking about?
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Next month, for the first time in four decades, Libya will hold its first open elections. But the shadow of the old regime hangs over the process. According to the Agence France-Presse, anyone with ties to the Muammar Gaddafi government cannot run in the elections. And a law passed 2 weeks ago criminalizes glorifying Gaddafi. That's not all. The law also punishes anyone who offends the Libyan uprising or the state or Islam. Sami Zaptia is editor of the Libya Herald. He says he's not sure what he's prohibited from doing.
It's very loose, it's very wide, it's very vague. Does it include the flag? Does it include the national anthem? Does it include the current prime minister and his government and his ministers? It is a step back in the wrong direction.
The language of this law is not all that dissimilar to that of other states in the region. There are red lines everywhere.
Yeah, but we would like to think that we are moving ahead and moving forward. We are hoping to see ourselves maybe more in line with Tunisia and the new Arab Spring nations. We are hoping to get away from those words, red lines. Libyans have a complex with that phraseology, red lines, because that's what the Gaddafi family used to tell us and warn us not to transgress the red lines, which included the Gaddafi family, his tribe, his philosophy, his green book.
Till now, have you seen any evidence that the National Transitional Council has an authoritarian streak, that you could go from the frying pan to the fire?
Let's put it this way. The NTC is a dictatorship, but it is a benign dictatorship. And the only guarantor that this is not going to last forever is, of course, that by this June, there would be elections for a parliament, for a congress that would draft a new constitution, choose a new government, that would choose a new prime minister.
Now, the elections are coming up next month. That's not a coincidence, right?
The NTC could have decreed such a law when Libya was declared liberated. They didn't, and they did it just before elections. There is another view that, in fact, speaking to a member of the NTC today, that this law partially protects pro-Gaddafi supporters. There is no sympathy for them whatsoever, and if any pro-Gaddafi supporters were to dare come out and manifest their support for the old regime by carrying the old green flag or his green book, or for God forbid, even a poster or picture of him, blood would be spilt. So maybe really the aim is to defuse any such conflicts, any such clashes. That could be one reason, as opposed to really the NTC wanting to protect itself or the government from criticism.
A story in the Libya Herald, your paper, posted on Tuesday, quotes a former Minister of Justice criticizing the new law as, quote, a shameful duplication of the past. Under a broad interpretation of the law, this very article about the former minister's criticism could itself be a violation. Has the law till now had a chilling effect on the stories that you publish?
Not at all. I mean, we're not going to go out of our way to insult the Libyan flag or the Libyan national anthem, but there's no way we're going to stop criticizing any ministers, ministerial decisions. We try to be constructive. We try to depersonalize our criticism. We're more concerned about policy, the thrust of decisions and laws. You know, Libya democracy is nascent, and we haven't got to the advanced stage in the West, or definitely in Britain with the tabloids, of course. We're far from that now.
You've been back in Libya for 6 years, having spent 30 years in England, which means that you were laboring under the Gaddafi rule. First of all, I wonder what it's like to have been a journalist under those circumstances. I guess secondly, I want to know if you have an eerie sense of deja vu.
I was writing for a state-controlled, if not owned, publication. I was responsible for at least one edition to be cancelled. They were not distributed because I criticized a policy to import doctors from a neighboring country, which I thought was completely wrong when we have thousands of Libyan doctors abroad refusing to come to Libya. And I dared to raise the question, why is it that they would not come back and work in their own nation? After a while, you learn to self-edit and you learn to write in between the lines, alluding to issues and hinting to them, and the readers become sophisticated, knowing the environment we had to work in. When the law first came out, we all raised our eyebrows. You know, it was a throwback, a little flash to the kind of rules and regulations controlling what is said, what is not said, that we used to live under and we used to have to work under.
So will you now once again have to practice journalism by subtext?
No, I don't think it's that bad. This government can barely keep physical control of the nation. The court system is barely up. You know, they barely have time to put Saif al-Gaddafi on trial, yet alone put somebody like me, a minor person like me, on trial. They're probably wishing to use it more as a deterrent as opposed to an aggressive tool. Well, that's my hope anyway.
Sami, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Sami Zaptia is editor of the Libya Herald. Mein Kampf is one of the most notorious books of the 20th century, but few people have actually read it, and almost no Germans have. Why? Because the owners of the copyright since 1946 have refused to publish the book in Germany. But as the copyright's 2015 expiration date approaches, Germans are struggling to figure out how to responsibly publish such a work. It's a decision ultimately left to a single German state, the copyright owner, Bavaria. Nicholas Pfeiffer is a professor of University of Cologne's Institute for Media and Communication Law. He says that Bavaria has been the custodian of all of Hitler's property since the end of World War II.
Germany enacted a law that said the state could take away the estate and property of the National Socialist Party and of its leaders. As Hitler had his domicile in Munich, the state of Bavaria was to take the estate that was in Bavaria, including the copyright. It was an excellent means to suppress the publication of Mein Kampf after the war, because you wouldn't have to argue about whether there's a constitutional conflict with giving a ban on publication of this book.
In 1945, I'm sure 70 years seemed like a long time, but lo and behold, it's just around the corner, and Mein Kampf will revert to the public domain. Is there any pent-up demand for Mein Kampf?
Well, after nearly 70 years, there is a certain demand of getting to know what's the fuss about the book. So in 2016, on January 1st, when the copyright is released, many commercial versions, also cheap versions, will be on the market, and the state of Bavaria now has to think fast about how to get a certain kind of control over the market of opinions. So it's high time to think about a solution to that problem.
In fact, somebody has thought of a solution. There is in the works an annotated version of Mein Kampf, subsidized by the government. What will it look like?
There is no clear knowledge about what the original text is that was written or dictated by Hitler himself. So this group of historians will try to find out what the real version is. They will also try to give explanations concerning the sources Hitler used when he wrote this book. And the group will give information of what Hitler had rightly understood by his sources and what he got completely wrong.
There's been some criticism of the notion of annotating this 800-page screed, because an annotation presumes some sort of literary merit to begin with. Now, I haven't read Mein Kampf, but I gather it's quite unhinged.
Those persons who have read it say it's completely unreadable. However, Churchill said if people had read it before the war, we would have known more exactly what this person was planning. There is one sentence saying that if 10 or 15,000 Jews had been gassed, then millions of German soldiers in the First World War would have survived. At least one could argue what this person was like, what was going on in his mind.
I want to talk about the First Amendment that you don't have. Here, this would be a non-issue because almost all speech is tolerated, even hate speech. Germany, after the war, has taken two apparently opposing paths. It has done a tremendous amount of introspection and study on the Nazi period while banning anything that can be regarded as hate speech or Holocaust denial. Has the government achieved what it wanted to do by suppressing speech?
That's a hard question. You were mentioning we don't have a First Amendment. We don't have it as you have it in the form of a freedom of expression, but we have a similar provision in our Constitution. And this Article 5 differs between opinions and facts. And when it comes to facts, it differs again between true facts, false facts, and knowingly false facts. And this last group are not protected by the Constitution. So the expression that there has never been anything like concentration camps, it's a proven historical fact that this is wrong. You know that it's wrong. And if you want to say it, you're not protected by the Constitution. And that might help in a democratic society in Germany after the war that was maybe weaker than the democratic society in England and maybe also in the United States.
I mentioned pent-up demand. When this book is published, what's going to happen? Is it going to fly off the shelves? Or do you think German society as a whole will go, never mind?
It's not going to fly off the shelves. Many people will buy it, I'm sure about that. And that is an experience in those countries in which the book was published, even in recent years. But people will soon detect that it's not interesting stuff. It's not fun to read. So in certain circles, it will circulate as a symbol. In historic, academic, and school circles, it will be read, it will be discussed, but it won't be a bestseller.
Nicholas, thank you so much.
Welcome.
Nicholas Pfeiffer is a professor at the University of Cologne's Institute for Media and Communication Law.
Mein Kampf, the cornerstone argument for the Third Reich, is a cut-and-dried example of hate speech. But no matter how vile, how irredeemable, it is published here in the United States. Jeremy Waldron, author of The Harm in Hate Speech, might ask why. And you might answer, because of the First Amendment of the Constitution. But Waldron believes that the First Amendment doesn't and shouldn't protect the most extreme forms of hate speech. And he asks you to consider an anecdote. A father and his two children are walking in their American town shortly after September 11th. The family is Muslim, and they encounter some particularly virulent and public invective aimed directly at them.
And he looks at them, he tries to shield them from it. He knows what it means. It means that they are not going to be welcome, or that somebody is trying to persuade others to not make them welcome. We have to understand this matter intelligently, and that does mean looking at it not just through my eyes as a white liberal who say, well, I can take this, I can handle this, but through the eyes of people who have to live their lives, do their business, raise their children in an atmosphere that is poisoned by this sort of abuse.
Are you pitting one of America's founding principles against the admittedly horrible predicament this father finds himself in?
Indeed, I am asking us at least to question that founding principle or to think about its limits.
But this is America, Jeremy. Our First Amendment forces us to be free speech absolutists, doesn't it?
I don't believe so. Certainly, if it forces us, it's a force that we've been able to resist quite well in other areas. So we still have laws of defamation. We still have laws of obscenity. We still have laws of child pornography. We still have some laws of sedition. And we still have laws regulating fighting words. So in all sorts of ways, we're not absolutists.
Anthony Lewis, the longtime legal scholar, wrote that hypersensitivity to hate speech has resulted in the absurd and stultifying so-called political correctness that prevailed on college campuses in the 90s. He said there even a sense of humor was endangered. What do you make of the slippery slope argument?
I don't think it was a bad idea to have rather more civil and respectful discourse on college campuses. And most big employers in the United States have speech codes because you can't run a business with half the workforce insulting the other half. So this is something that we know how to deal with in certain settings. There is a slippery slope problem. It's not the one that Anthony talks about. It's the one about suppressing genuine dissent and reducing the plurality of voices that are heard in the community. But well-drafted legislation in every other advanced democracy has confronted this slippery slope problem and developed strategies for dealing with it.
You teach both at New York University and at Oxford. How does Great Britain draw that line?
In about three different ways. One is in the careful wording of the statute. So you might have a provision that says a person who uses threatening, abusive, or insulting words or behavior or displays any written material which is threatening, abusive, or insulting is guilty of an offense if he intends thereby to stir up racial hatred. Prosecutions need the support of the Director of Public Prosecutions, and there is some control or filter to try to bend over backwards to catch only the most egregious cases. Most such pieces of legislation include a sense of various safe havens where people can say what they like in their homes or in private conversations. The difficulty we want to address is a situation where somebody is bellowing out in public invective, abuse, and threatening language that tends to make life massively difficult for the families that we imagined in that example a few moments ago.
So if you were king for a day, what would your ideal hate speech regulation look like in the United States?
In the United States, we have a tendency to panic. We say, well, how on earth would we draft these laws? How would we stop the slippery slope, as though we would have to reinvent the wheel? In the 1950s, there was a case from Illinois that went before the Supreme Court, Beauharnais against Illinois, and it dealt with a particularly vicious piece of racist propaganda that was being purveyed on the streets of Chicago. And the Supreme Court had no difficulty upholding that as effectively a group libel statute, making it an offense to seriously defame a group in the community by calling them criminals or by calling them violent. And that decision in Beauharnais against Illinois has never been overturned. What you find in the United States is opinion is divided on this.
Obviously, the one thing you can't legislate away is hateful thoughts.
Yes.
How do you think restricting the words people can use in a society addresses the underlying problem of hate?
It doesn't. I mean, it makes it harder for the haters, for the racists, to call out and contact each other. Because effectively what one of these pieces of signage does, it says two things. To one audience, it says, you're not welcome here. And to another audience, it says, you're not alone. There are lots of people who have this hatred as well as you do. So be emboldened, be encouraged. But I'm under no illusion that this diminishes hate. Remember, this would be one of dozens of strategies that would be used to deal with problems of inequality and antipathy between different communities.
Because of your less than absolutist views on the First Amendment,
yes,
you've amassed an impressive heap of hate mail yourself. Would you restrict it?
I wouldn't restrict it if it were just a matter of mail being sent to me. I think that's one of these safe havens. It's not by no means pleasant. It's actually very unpleasant. But that's between you and the person who sent it. What really worries me is people thinking that it's appropriate to hate those who simply raise this issue.
Jeremy, thank you very much.
It's been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you.
Jeremy Waldron is a professor at New York University and at Oxford. His new book is called The Harm in Hate Speech.
Coming up, the West doesn't seem to take free speech in Africa as seriously as African journalists do.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at PoetryFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Once African leaders like Mele Zenawi of Ethiopia and Paul Kagame of Rwanda were hailed as political reformers and praised for their efforts to curb terrorism and reduce poverty. But Mohamed Keita, Africa Advocacy Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, says the civil rights abuses of those leaders have been largely unremarked upon by Western governments and media. It's Western cynicism about African democracy that has encouraged governments to drop press freedom from their agendas, and that's left them pretty much unaccountable to anyone.
Africa is the region of the world that has driven the largest number of journalists into exile, over 360 journalists. Between 2001 and 2011, most of them came from the Horn of Africa. In the case of Ethiopia, the government has passed a law that has virtually wiped out all civil society working on democratization or human rights.
But in the 1990s, African leaders like Mele Zenawi of Ethiopia were hailed as reformers.
There was tremendous renaissance across Africa following the fall of the Berlin Wall. The 90s were an era of reform of and democratization, liberalization of the press, the end of single-party rule, But many of the leaders from that era have grown to be authoritarian. You have donor countries spending a lot of money to build institutions that are supposed to defend human rights and press freedom, but it's not enough to spend a lot of money building institutions or training journalists. You also have to really be engaged at the political level to ensure that the governments do build truly democratic institutions, not government fronts like in Ethiopia or Rwanda.
But you suggest that these donor nations aren't staying engaged and that, in fact, their priorities don't really rate press freedom very highly.
No, they don't. Last November, one of Sweden's leading newspapers interviewed Sweden's international development minister about two Swedish reporters who have been imprisoned in Ethiopia since last July. The Swedish minister said that the government was raising these issues privately with the Ethiopian government. But, she said, at the same time, Prime Minister Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia has been a champion in anti-poverty and development. Western governments are no longer putting reform, human rights, and democracy at the top of their agenda. It's cynicism about African democracy. It is acceptable now to have elections full of irregularities. A few governments will issue statements criticizing such and such elections, but at the end of the day, the reform agenda has fallen off.
Because these countries seem to be making strides towards
development. Yes, but even as they register this progress, there are questions about the extent of this progress, how the life of the ordinary person has improved or not improved. And, you know, even the World Bank admits that there is a huge gap between their GDP growth figures and the inflated GDP growth figures of the government. So who is there to really account for that gap? If without a free press, you have no accountability, not only for the millions that are given in international assistance, but you also have no reliable figures about the extent of this development.
How does Zenawi justify the crackdown on journalists?
At this point, these authoritarian leaders are becoming more and more assertive in justifying this oppression. They are openly rejecting Western liberal democratic values in favor of an authoritarian model taken after China.
What kind of influence do you think is China having on media in Africa?
Opening bureaus of the state-controlled news agency Xinhua currently has more bureaus in Africa than any of the Western news agencies. At the same time, since 2004, more than 200 African journalists have been flown to China for training in positive reporting, which also converges with the African authoritarian leaders' promotion of what they call developmental journalism. So the whole idea that the media, instead of reporting on so-called divisive or sensational news, should focus on positive or collective achievements and get the masses behind the state.
The Chinese company ZTE has apparently installed and financed a telecom network in Ethiopia. Does it have an impact on the content carried on those lines?
Yeah, Ethiopia operates the most extensive internet censorship infrastructure in sub-Saharan Africa. This is quite a paradox because Ethiopia's telecom infrastructure is still very poor compared to even neighboring Kenya or Somalia. Yet they have this very sophisticated internet censorship apparatus, and they block critical content. And when there is a humanitarian disaster, journalists are forced to wait until the government calls it a famine to actually call it a famine. International journalists based in Ethiopia are facing the constant threat of expulsion, and obviously the local journalists are facing much more persecution.
Does social media, either locally or internationally, have any impact?
Some of the biggest stories in Africa today are broken by social media users on Twitter or Facebook. When a crisis breaks out in any given country, you will see international media trying to go on Twitter to find local users based in that area to get firsthand accounts or exclusive photos or images.
But what about in the Horn of Africa?
The progress is slower. In the case of Ethiopia, it was not until last September that the government finally allowed mobile phone service to come with internet access. In other words, to have smartphone, not until last September. In Eritrea, that is still not allowed. In Somalia, it's much more open. The telecom infrastructure in Somalia is actually quite amazing. Even though it's a failed state, it's quite a wired country.
Let's assume we don't think there's any intrinsic value in free speech. What are the practical consequences of censorship in that region?
When there is a famine and the government imposes censorship and forces the media to downplay the extent of the famine, lives are lost, clearly, because there are international groups that want to assist and to also have access to those sensitive areas. I just wanted to say a word about the ordinary journalists in Africa. If you see a photo on the front page of the New York Times from Somalia, think about the person that took that photo and the risk they went through to take that picture. In Somalia, they are very young. They're all in their 20s. They are so brave. They live in a war zone. Somalia is the deadliest place for journalists in Africa. But they are really, truly our eyes on the ground. And without them, we really don't have a clue about what's happening in those countries. And I also want to say that local journalists are truly the ones that most need support and assistance because they lack institutional support. Without them, our international reporters couldn't operate on the ground. International journalists fly in and out. They have diplomatic assistance. When they're arrested immediately, they are on CNN. But the local journalists who actually live in those countries, who speak the language, who have access to the best sources and understand the politics and the dynamics of the situation, they are without any protection, and we must recognize them.
Mohamed Keita, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mohamed Keita is the Africa Advocacy Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. We just heard him outline the perils for local journalists. One such is May Azanga. Working as one of the few female reporters in her country, Azanga reported on a practice that is both deeply entrenched and highly taboo in Liberia, female genital cutting.
The Women's Secret Society is called the Sandy Society, S-A-N-D-E, and the Male Secret Society is called the Poro, P-O-R-O, Poro Society. They will take the young people and train them to be proper men and women. But the prerequisite for the female, you will have to be circumcised to graduate. In the interior, the people there are pressured to send their children to these schools because if they don't, you will be ostracized. You will be treated as an outcast. They call you sinner.
How much reporting has there been on female genital cutting?
For foreign journalists, okay. But for me, who's a Liberian and know the practice and know the culture, is a taboo.
So what happened?
When I wrote this story, everybody was angry because they felt I let out a secret I shouldn't have done. I tried to talk to several women who shy away. Oh, no, I don't. No. I can't talk about the people thing. Oh, it's too big for my mouth. And this lady I talked with, she agreed to talk with me, but we had to go in a secret room. Even as we were there, she was scared. She was looking everywhere. Because the secret of this is you have to make an oath or swear an oath not to tell. And they will always make an oath the day I tell I should die. So while they were hunting me, probably they wanted my source.
They wanted your source. Mohammed Keita told us that there were death threats against you and your 9-year-old daughter.
They sent a lot of death threats to my editor, to my news office, Front Page Africa, and they said, for putting my mouth in their business, I'm going to pay dearly for it. My editor even called me because I was in a rural village, and she said, the people are waiting. The people say they will catch you and carry you to the sand and have you cut. Then they will keep your mouth shut. You won't say anything. That's their belief. If they cut you, you swear an oath. You won't be able to tell. So they wanted to keep my mouth shut. They went to my house looking for my 9-year-old daughter. These women, I don't know them. And the lady who takes care of my daughter had to run into a neighbor's house and hide my daughter. And she called me that day. I can remember it was March on the 14th. And I told the nanny to send her to a distant relative out of Monrovia because I was afraid. Because the traditional people believe if they can't get you, they will get someone closer to you.
What was the government's response when you reached out to it for protection?
The government never gave me security. I was in hiding for over 3 weeks.
You didn't have a great relationship with the police to begin with, did you?
No, I didn't, because I had been hard on them. We did a story on police brutality. This woman's daughter was raped, and when she went to report the case, the police beat her and threw her in jail. And her 12-year-old daughter still lies at the house. She did not go to a hospital, because the mother was thrown in jail. She was there for 3 days. Her daughter was not treated as a result. And then they told her, who know you? Nobody know you. I told her, did they tell you that? She said, yeah. I said, somebody will know you. When I'm finished, when we finish reporting this story, somebody's going to know you. And we did that story. The police didn't like it because they were implicated.
Were you helped by the international community?
Oh, yeah. A lot of pressure from the international community, I would say.
Who?
CPJ.
The Committee to Protect Journalists.
Yes. Amnesty International. Columbia University Student Schema. CUNY University Student Schema. To tell the president that they should provide security protection for me. That put pressure on the government to say the Sandy Society that is responsible for circumcision of the women should be suspended for time indefinite.
Do you believe the government will take concrete steps to stop female genital mutilation? Do you think you changed anything?
Yeah. For the government to come up and say that, it had not been done in the past, so it was a milestone. But they still need to. It needs education, awareness. So the general minister said they will go into the villages and educate these people to stop it.
Why did you take on this story, May?
They were violating the little children's right. They said the school, the bush school, as they call it, the sandy bush, was to make women ready to get married. Teach them how to take care of their husband. But can a 3-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 5-year-old child run a home after you cut her? No. So you are violating that child's right. You, as a parent, you send her there. But you don't know the future implication. A lot of women are traumatized because of that. Because the lady I talked with, she said they pinned her down. There were 4 women who pinned her down. And the 5th woman was over her and cut her. No sort of anesthesia they gave you. She said raw pin, she described it. She said the pin so severe. And they don't give you pills, she said. They just mashed the leaf and put it to the affected area. Medically, the doctor told me it was dangerous. Because when women go to give birth, they have massive tear and other things, and some of them even die.
You reported on child rape and forced the president to intervene in a case of police brutality against the mother of a rape victim. You were the first reporter to interview Liberian mercenaries who admitted to murdering civilians in the Ivory Coast during the 2010 election. In 2007, you spoke out against the sexual harassment of female reporters, for which you got a lot of criticism. Last year, you won a Pulitzer Center grant to cover reproductive health in Liberia. You're a journalist on a crusade, aren't you?
Yes, I will say that. Mm-hmm.
What's your background? You were forced into exile during the war.
Mm-hmm. I stayed in Liberia throughout the war. And then 1996, when Charles Taylor and Roosevelt Johnson, another rebel group, it was Friday the 13th when they dragged my father, who used to be Associate Justice, from the dining room table. I will never forget.
Tell me about your father.
My father used to be Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. And when the war came, the rebels were looking for people working in the government. They looted everything from my house and took my father away. From that day, that moment, our life changed. He was jailed, he was beaten, he was brutalized. When he came to America, he died. He suffered brain cancer because they used a gun to beat his head.
What's your ultimate goal?
To help as many people as possible. That is why I didn't go into politics. I have to talk with the ordinary people. I have to walk by them every day. And they too have stories. If I don't tell their story, who will listen to them? Who will hear their voices? I'm a reporter with All Boulder. I go everywhere to report. I report for a change. I feel the injustices in my country too much. And nobody waiting to talk about it because other journalists are bought. And nobody, I can boast now, nobody in my country willing to give me bribe because they are afraid of me as Ango. That name sounds like a chewing gum. Everybody knows me. Even if you haven't seen me, that name scares people. So nobody will come up with a purse and say, May, I want you to kill this story. Because when I go after a story, my uncle always said, when May Azango come after you, you better run.
Oh, yeah. May Azango.
Yeah, that name. Whew. I can tell you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
May Azango reports on human rights for New Narratives and Front Page Africa.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Rob Schoon, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.